The Parenting Unpacked podcast is recorded on Yuggera and Yugambeh Bundjalung land. We acknowledge the Turrbal, Yuggera and Kumbumerri people as its traditional custodians. We acknowledge all First Peoples of this land and celebrate their enduring connections to country, knowledge and stories. We pay our respects to the elders, those who have passed into the dreaming, those here today and those of tomorrow.
Hello and welcome back to Parenting Unpacked. You're here with Dr. Kristen Summer and not Siobhan Kennedy Costantini because Siobhan has been struck down by a terribly awful cold and we are not very organized at the moment, so we don't have a stack of recordings lined up in case she gets sick. So I am recording this one all on my lonesome, but that is okay because today we are talking about surrogacy in India, specifically with a really brilliant researcher that I connected with last week on Instagram who was like, oh yeah, I just work at Griffith University. And I was like, wait, me too. And she's like, I'm on the Gold Coast campus. And I'm like, oh my God, me too. So we ended up connecting and talking over coffee. And I just thought she was so brilliant and had such an interesting story to tell because she does field work in India with surrogate mothers. So in today's episode, we talk to Lopa Mundra Goswani, who is a PhD student here at Griffith University in the School of Health Sciences and Social Work. And she walks us through the really incredible things that she did or listened to. She did a lot of observational work in India between 2014 and 2019. She got locked into India, which is where she's from. So she kind of just got locked into home during the COVID pandemic. She was there and interviewing and learning about gestational surrogate mothers throughout all of that experience. And it was just such an interesting perspective to hear. So we talk about surrogacy in India. We talk about what it was like in 2014 when it was commercial. We talk about what surrogacy in India is like today. It is no longer allowed to be commercial. It can only be altruistic. An altruistic surrogacy can only be partaken in by other Indian citizens. So it cannot be an international intended parent anymore, which is really interesting because at one point babies were one of India's most thriving exports. So she tells us all about her experiences listening to mothers, why they didn't feel exploited despite many people with privilege thinking that it was exploitation. And she just regales us with some really interesting stories. So this is a very different one for Parenting Unpacked. We don't usually talk about surrogacy. We don't usually talk about qualitative research, but it was so interesting. And it's something I would love to learn more about. So if you really enjoyed this episode, please let us know and hit us up. But yeah, I will flick you over to the episode now so you can listen to my conversation with Lopa. And we will be back after the episode. And by we, I mean me. I'm still in the me and Siobhan mindset. I'm very lonely and lost without her. But we wish her the speediest of recoveries so that I am not alone again next week. Although we have another guest next week as well. So we will survive. But anyways, let's get into the episode with Lopa. Hey, Lopa. It's so wonderful to have you on today.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
Very well. It's not raining finally, so it's good.
Thank really the Lord. So Lopa, can you tell me a little bit about who you are, what your life is like? Give me a bit of a rundown.
Okay, brilliant. So I'm a researcher. I research on surrogacy with a particular focus on developing countries, especially India. So yeah, I've been doing this since 2014. I'm actually from India as well. And right now I'm pursuing a PhD from Griffith University here in Australia. My life's work's turned into a PhD thesis essentially. So, or I hope so. We'll see.
We love that. We love that. Now, Lopa, tell me why surrogacy Why surrogacy? Oh my goodness, I'm tripping over my words today. Why surrogacy? Why did you get into it? What made you pursue it? Tell me all the details.
Right. Yeah. Quite honestly, I was pretty unaware of what was going on because there's so many things going on in India at that point in time. And I was very happily studying animal assisted therapy for children on the spectrum. And I went to present at a conference, and this American researcher, who's now my life mentor as well, Dr. Karen Smith Rotabi, was essentially doing this research. And was looking for a country head to lead this project in India. And there I was, and she grabbed me and said, "You're the person, and let's go." So it was pretty easy, to be honest. It's and this is a conference. She came from the United States. I was there from India in Sri Lanka. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like fate just put us together. And I've always been very interested in working in the sector of women, and especially with, in terms of health, essentially, I would say, well, all around, but like mental health in particular. So yeah, my background's in psychology. So obviously that was an interest. So yeah, it pretty much landed on my lap, and I couldn't be, more stoked about it. So yeah, for sure, that's how it started. However, like as I went on my first field trip back in 2014, I very quickly understood what it was all about, how India was the surrogacy capital of the world at that point in time, why it was, and what was the expanse of things happening. It just blew my mind. So, and that's the reason I stayed on.
Wow, that's quite the journey. So can you tell me a little bit about what your first field trip in 2014 looked like, what you were doing, what you were exploring?
Yeah, so essentially we went to this place, it's a state in India called Gujarat, which was sort of the hub with a lot of people coming from around the world and India, obviously, to sort of commission a baby in a way. They were at that point in time known as commissioning parents, which is obviously now translated to intending parents. So I honestly just went with no leads. And this is what I love about my mentor at that point in time, because she just said, "Go ahead, you know, this is the money, this is what it is, figure it out," right? Like she gave me obviously some leads in terms of like what is where, like what hospitals and things like that. So I rocked up there with another, friend of mine, and we essentially just started going from, hospital door to hospital door, and just started, asking people. And we kind of got lucky because we stayed in a hotel, which was kind of a surrogacy hotel. Like it wasn't meant to be so, but being one of the better hotels, it was where parents were coming and staying as well. So we got a lot of leads from there as well. Obviously, speaking languages, which are, from that part of the country helped as well. We took it forward from there. And we literally had women waiting outside our hotel door to come interview. Early in the morning, coming from like neighboring villages. It was absolutely fascinating. So this trip we interviewed surrogate mothers. I think within 2 weeks we had about 25 women that interviewed, and that's the story there. So
what were you interviewing them about?
So we were essentially trying to understand what their understanding of exploitation was, and we sort of piggyback on like this other researcher, who's this really known researcher in the space of surrogacy. Her name's Dr. Amrita Pandey, and she's done seminal work. Sometimes I wish I was her, she's done so much work in this aspect. It's almost exhaustive. And so we sort of try to understand what women thought of exploitation and if they felt exploited being surrogates. And yeah, so that is pretty much the broad idea we went with. And we were absolutely baffled sort of getting an understanding of what exploitation was, and also like questioning our own privileges at that point in time, because what might look like an exploitation for you and me might be so different for somebody who comes from absolute abject poverty conditions. So it was quite the learning curve, like straight off the bat right there. So yes.
So the women that you were interviewing were gestational surrogates. They were carrying not their egg, they were carrying the intended parent's egg. Is that correct?
So the first part's correct, that they were not, they did not contribute their eggs. So they were gestational surrogates. However, it may or may not have been both the intending parents' genetic material. Yeah, so it could have been both the intending parents, genetic material, or it could have been one donor as well. So there are so many different, combinations in this setup. So it's quite difficult to, say this was exactly what it was. But yeah, you're absolutely right in pointing out with India, it is only gestational surrogacy. So there's no form of traditional surrogacy that's allowed in India. And these surrogate mothers may have been donors themselves. However, they don't get to carry their own egg. So
right. Okay, so I think we probably need to step back a little bit and talk about how surrogacy works in India, or worked in 2014, because you did tell me that it has changed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But can you describe to me the process through which an intended parent might go about acquiring a commercial gestational surrogate in India in 2014? What did that look like, and where did those intended parents come from?
Yeah, so they came from all over the world, literally all over the world. Obviously, India was great in regards to, obviously, it was way cheaper compared to countries like the United States, for example. There was an abundance of surrogate mothers available. People also had a lot of control with regards to, these surrogate mothers essentially lived in hostels, where they were monitored. Yeah, they were living far away from their families. So every step of their life was like, medication or essential rest, and everything was monitored, food, nutrition, things like that. So these are women we are talking about who come from remote areas in India where they are doing everything. So from carrying pails of water from the river or the nearby well or something like that to feed their family, doing everything household related chore, right? So I think it was one of the reasons why hostels were also there, because they wanted to make sure that the baby stays and there's no, case of miscarriage, just control in general. Another reason also that I read was that, these are women in India, in these places essentially weren't smoking or drinking alcohol. So again, it worked really well for the intending parents as well, and for the doctors to monitor and things like that. So, I actually lost your question. What was the question again?
That is totally fine. Let me sum up what you've said so far, though. So the gestational surrogate mothers were mostly mothers who came from impoverished circumstances. India is a developing country and has a pretty significant poverty-stricken population. So these mothers were very likely mothers themselves.
Yeah, they were. So in India, again, for you to be a surrogate mother, you have to have, you have to have had a child of your own. So it in a sense shows that you were able to go through with a pregnancy. So that is a must. And obviously spousal consent is also very necessary. So India essentially was only allowing for gestational surrogacy, and it was mostly commercial. I have not met anybody so far where they did it altruistically so far. I mean, at least back then. And then things have changed since that time. So my one project was in 2014, another was in 2016, and my own PhD data collection was in 2019. 2019-2020, so just before the pandemic, essentially. So yeah, a lot has changed since then, and it's a very interesting thing, because there's a lot on paper that happens, but there's also so much that goes on, you know, in the background. So sometimes when people ask me, like, okay, so exactly what it is, so it's a tricky question to answer, because I'll say, yeah, it's not allowed, but then I'll hear from the field from somebody that, oh, actually it's still going on, you know, or it's still happening in this way. So
Let me summarize again. So these impoverished mothers from India back in 2014 were solicited or commissioned to carry an intended parent's baby from anywhere around the world. The gestational surrogate mother was then placed in a hostel in a larger city, where they weren't near their family for the entire duration of the pregnancy. And they were obviously housed and fed, and they were given obviously a stipend for carrying the intended parent's baby. And then what happened after delivery? So once they had the baby, what happened next? Were they, how much medical care were they given, or were they immediately returned to their family? What happened?
Right. Okay. Before I come back to this, essentially their families could come and visit them in the hostel. Yeah.
Okay.
But a lot of times, you know, if they were in far away cities as well, like, it was quite difficult for the families to come visit as well. So I mean, they weren't not allowed, but it was just that they couldn't go back home. In some cases, they did go home for some festival or something like that, but they were just worried. So right after they deliver, a lot of times in a vast majority of cases, the surrogate mothers do not get to see the baby that they just birthed. So and in most cases, so for, you know, like, there were mothers who've had one child, two children, more sometimes, and they've almost always had natural births for their own biological kids. However, when it comes to surrogacy, it's almost always a C-section delivery. And again, there are so many reasons for that as well. You know, convenience of the medical practitioner, of the intending parents, for them to be there for the birth, and all of that. And these are women, you know, who are perfectly healthy, you know, until then. And a lot of times, I mean, like, with a C-section, if it's something that you choose to do, and it's your own choice, but with these women, they don't have that choice a lot of times. They'll just, you know, I've asked them, like, so you've also had your own children with a, you know, with a natural birth, how come you went ahead for this? And they were like, oh, this was a part of the procedure, you know, this is what we signed up for. Or they'd say things like, oh, the doctor would say, we'll see. But in a sense, almost every time, or in every case, they'd say, oh, the baby's too big, or, you know, it would be very critical, you know, if anything were to happen to the baby. And I think out of fear that they wouldn't be able to deliver a healthy living child or children, because a lot of times it's also twins, they just say, yeah, go for it. Like, you know, just go there, get the baby out. You know, it depends agency to agency. So that's what happens when things are not regulated, right? Now, there are agencies or agents that I've heard horror stories where women had their transfer done, and, you know, once it was successful, it takes about a couple of weeks or so to see, like, you know, the embryo has stayed, and after that, like, in some cases, they were just left to their own devices, and they were and the agents disappeared until the 8th or the 9th month. Because they were back again to get their commission. So So literally, this mother who doesn't know what's happening to her is now carrying a child. doesn't know if somebody's going to come and collect it or not. That's one end, whereas on the other end as well, there are agents who are extremely caring, will go out of their way to sort of look after the family of the surrogate mother as well, really pay attention to, what's happening with their mental health and everything as well. So yeah, again, it's a huge, huge spectrum. And I'm happier when I meet people on this side where they've been taken care of. However, I've also met quite a few on the other side as well. So yeah, right after delivery, don't see the baby in most cases. A lot of times it's interesting when intending parents who have been in contact with the surrogate mother would say, oh yeah, of course, we are going to show you the baby and everything. And a lot of times they just disappear right after the birth. So these moms who thought like through this time that they would see the baby, they were not expecting any kind of relationship with them, obviously, long term, but at least to see the baby, are kind of left, you know, like with no answers, no closure. And then, up until the surgery, you had a baby in your belly and now you don't. So that's it. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's so, it's so transactional. And I know that this is not the case of surrogacy worldwide. There are very different experiences. And I imagine this speaks to why commercial surrogacy is no longer allowed in India, but it sounds very transactional. It sounds like sometimes women are fully informed of what they will experience and sometimes they are not. And then they're almost trapped into these circumstances and, as you say, exploited. So I find that wild. So when you interviewed these mothers, about their experience with exploitation, what did you find the majority of them spoke about?
Exactly. So this is very interesting because, again, they do not feel exploited. And the concept of exploitation is so different to them. What we look at as, you know, as exploitation from our end, it's a matter of choice, because for them, they're like, here I have my own family that I have to feed. I can either go in the corner of the street in my city or somewhere else and work as a sex worker, or, you know, do something else. I mean, a lot of times they very commonly sort of like compare it with sex work. Again, nothing to do with that, but, you know, they'll always say something like, oh, you know, it had nothing to do with that. So this baby's like made in the lab. So just to show that, because there's a huge question of morality and everything in India as well. But they do not feel exploited. In fact, it's so interesting because a lot of times what I've seen through their narratives is that they come out really empowered. And it is so fascinating and it's so incredible to see that, because a lot of times they would often say something like, I was a nobody until I did this. And then I became a surrogate mother and I brought money to the table. And now I am somebody, you know, it is me who made sure my children can go to a better school. It is me who, got this house, or it is me who could, you know, get an auto rickshaw for my husband so that he has a job. Or, you know, maybe because he's, you know, like so many reasons. Yeah. And I was so, so blown away because, you know, like it was interesting because back in 2014, I really went in so naive and my mentor sort of like did not push in towards like me reading a lot about it either. So I just went like an empty slate there with an empty slate with very basic information. And so I was not biased towards either end or whatever. So that's the thing with empowerment, like with their story of empowerment. So didn't feel exploited at all in most cases. Obviously they have their grievances with regards to how maybe they're looked after afterwards, or, you know, how they didn't get to see the child, or, you know, some medical situations. But almost always never felt exploited.
So from the mothers you interviewed in that first round of data, how many reported that they would do it again?
I forget the exact numbers, but this is, again, a very good question, because a lot of them actually said that they would also do it without money involved. Because, you know, yeah, if they would do it without money involved. Having said that, like, that is one thing that they said from 2014. But with my current research as well, a lot of them say we will do it without money. However, we deserve the money, you know. So they would do it because they've seen so many, you know, intending parents through their journey, because they would all be in the hostel. You know, if it's not your intending parent, somebody else's intending parents are there. And, you know, these couples would be, you know, sort of like they would have tried everything, and here they are finally getting closer to having a child, and they could see that. And a lot of times, again, this was so interesting. I remember when I think a few of them said it, like, in different states as well, so clearly they weren't talking to one another, but they would say something like, I might be poor, so I don't have money. But when you, like, you know, they didn't feel like these people were giving the money, so they were low. I have the ability to give them a child, and they have the ability to give them the money that I need to, you know, help my family. So it almost felt like they were equating, you know, themselves in this, in a transactional way. But, you know, I also felt like it was a form of empowerment that they felt, you know, that they were able to even look at it that way. So yeah, that was something.
That's incredibly interesting, because these mothers had to leave their children in order to carry these babies for, I assume, quite a few months. They a lot of times would have to undergo the, like, physical ramifications of pregnancy and childbirth, and it's not like they get the gift of a baby at the end, yet they felt empowered and like they had contributed to their family in a way they probably hadn't before. And I guess this is where the interaction between socioeconomic status or poverty and contribution to the family kind of comes into the fold. That's really, really interesting. So tell me then, what changed as India brought in its law that commercial surrogacy was no longer allowed?
Yeah. So India essentially is now in a situation where they are only allowing for altruistic surrogacy. And there's also one clause, I think, where you have to sort of know the person in a way. It's quite murky, to be honest, because I was recently back in India for member check, and I heard some stories with regards to, you know, there were babies that were born during the pandemic, and sort of, you know, parents couldn't come. Surrogate mother was obviously willing to look after the baby, obviously, like, if they could pay towards the upkeep of, you know, like buying milk and formula, whatever, all of that and things like that. Whereas, like, you know, this particular doctor apparently, you know, at some point just gave the baby away. And these parents so many horror stories that happen as well, which is so, so scary. So I think, I mean, it's a no-brainer almost that the way India should actually go forward is to regulate it. And essentially it works for the best for everybody, because right now, again, like, this was a known case in Bangalore in India, where somebody actually opened shop literally in, like, a garage, and was delivering babies right there. So yeah, you know, like with
not in a hospital, in a garage.
No, not in the hospital. No, exactly. Like sort of a thing, right? So these things, yeah, these things will happen when you don't regulate things, you know, when you can. And I remember every, like the surrogate mothers would refer to this person as Dr. So-and-so. And I was like, as far as I'm aware, he's not a doctor. So I went back to check and I was like, you never know, right? Like maybe they were like, you know, a medical doctor who got into this sort of a thing, became an agent and so on and so forth. Maybe there was more money in it. And then no, he doesn't have any medical degree, but because of the way he was interacting, probably even getting involved in the procedure and everything, surrogates who delivered in that situation thought he was a doctor. So you see like the issues that can arise from, yeah, not regulating it. So right now, again, like, you know, people who are doing it, yeah, like one of the agencies where I collected data, like they've closed down because they were following the book to the T, and essentially it was just getting more and more difficult. Whereas this other place that I know of, I think is still ongoing. Yeah, just because they're sort of like, you know, slipping through the cracks and yeah, making use of the loopholes. But also what was interesting is that sometimes you would go to a place which is probably a hostel or an agency and everything. And then if they notice that there's anything wrong, or you might be a reporter or a lawyer or something, and you show up the next time and it's completely vanished. So it doesn't exist anymore. So that was something as well. Wow. A lot of times, a lot of hospitals, like, yeah, asked me not to go back again because I knew surrogacy was happening there. But because obviously, like, you know, as part of my ethical, like, you know, ethical procedure, protocols. Yeah, I had to tell them why I was there and everything. So, yeah, I was literally told, please do not return here because, as we told you, there's no surrogacy happening here. So, yeah, that's the story. But I wait to see what else is also happening. I wasn't able to explore more in terms of, like, yeah, exactly what's going on. But I heard some stories and it was a very short time as well. So it'll be interesting to see where India goes with surrogacy. So
wow. So
yeah.
So in,
and sorry, before I forget, it's also banned international surrogacy as well. So it's only allowed for people within India, or at least have one partner who has an Indian citizenship or an OCI card, which is an overseas citizen of India. So, card. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So essentially India's gone from having one of its biggest export being babies essentially to, prohibiting, international surrogacy altogether and limiting only altruistic, surrogacy. Yeah. Although it sounds like some people are getting through the cracks and finding loopholes through all of that. But there's, you do have another interesting story, and I want to know, because you got caught in India as the pandemic came down. I mean, India is your home, so that makes sense that you would stay there. But I assume you got exposed to some of the horror stories that occurred in surrogacy during the pandemic. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened during the pandemic to surrogate mothers and what happened to those babies?
Yeah, very, very interesting, because I mean, the world was closing down, but you know, the babies were on their way. So one way or another, these babies had to find their way back home. So this was a part of my PhD as well, where you have to have a publication during your PhD. So my supervisors and I, we, you know, I was like, hey, this is happening in India, like, and they were like, let's do a paper out of it. So so I did some research and sat there like reading through newspaper articles and everything, and found out that there, you know, essentially, again, even like there were surrogate babies being born in cities where intending parents may or may not have been in. So, you know, these were babies who were being airlifted and dropped off to their parents during the course of the pandemic. In some cases, some of the surrogate mothers, I think, out of the goodness of their heart, like looked after these babies until the parents could sort of like drive, crossing multiple borders. And I mean, like Australia, India is also a huge country. So sometimes it can take you days and days to get through. And yeah, like with India, our first lockdown was intense. So yeah, like we've never seen our country like that, never could imagine our country being at a standstill like that. So people had to get multiple permissions and passes and things like that to go across borders. And finally be able to get to their babies as well. So it was good to see that. But I think the whole point of my paper was, again, once again, we do not get to hear what happened to the surrogate mothers, what happened to the moms who actually delivered these babies, what was done to make sure that they didn't get COVID. And in the event that they got COVID, you know, what happened? What about them when they have delivered? How are they going back to their towns and villages? You know, what protocols are being looked after? So that being my focal interest in research, it was strange to see that not much information was given out there pertaining to the surrogate mothers. So yeah, these are great. Oh, you know, babies being lifted, airlifted and dropped off to cities. But what about these surrogate mothers? So it sort of takes you back to that situation. I remember I was telling you about it the other day with Nepal and their earthquake when, some countries, for example, airlifted their babies and their citizens who were there to pick up their babies. So, but the surrogate mothers who had given birth essentially were left behind. So, yeah. I think, we are sort of forgetting a very important part of this, you know, equation, which is the surrogate mother. And I know it's very different in countries like Australia and the United States, where women, or even the UK, perhaps, where women have access to share, to actually articulate how they think, feel, what they're undergoing, and so on and so forth. I know American surrogates are very vocal with regards to their experiences and, you know, what they're doing, how they're, you know, processing the thoughts and ideas and all of that. But it's a very different cultural situation in countries like India. So,
Wow, that is mental. And it sounds like in all of your research, a common theme is that the surrogates are kind of forgotten. They're not really cared about once they have fulfilled their obligation of birthing a child. Yeah. The focus is on the child and not the mother. And I mean, that's pretty typical of whether you're a surrogate mother or a birthing mother who takes your baby home. Everyone focuses immediately from the pregnant woman to the baby and forgets all about the mother that just delivered a baby. But it seems so much worse when the baby is disconnected from the mother and then the mother is just left in dangerous situations like earthquakes, or is not really regarded very well in terms of like what to do in the middle of a pandemic with them. It seems very transactional in that it's like it sounds a little bit disposable.
Absolutely.
And that's really heavy. So I find it really bleak that in Western countries, surrogates can be championed more. I don't think it's perfect in Western countries either, but to hear about it in a developing country where it was a massive export for Western countries, that these women are treated with such little regard, yet they still feel so positively about it, so empowered by it. It's a very conflicting set of feelings and thoughts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it just stems from difference in your socioeconomic status. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, for example, in Australia, you know, if, you know, the poorest of the poor, you will not go without food with regards to the governmental help that you have here, right? And India, I think we are 1.3 billion people. There's no social security in that regard. So I mean, that's essentially many countries' population put together. I think we are 1/8 of the population or something like that. Mm. And yeah, so I think sometimes it's like, hey, like I had to sort of, I couldn't put food on the table, and then forgetting all the other issues, like, you know, alcoholism, like, you know, with partners, or, you know, violence and all of that put together. So sometimes a lot of times they would sort of like move away from their partners just to raise essentially their children and things like that. So yeah, I think it just spoke that things that we think of, like definitions, are quite different to people across the world based on their current situation. So
wow. Yeah,
and you're right, despite all of that, they're still saying we will do it again. You know, the joy I got to give somebody a childless couple a child, you know, I have never felt this, you know, great. Or like a lot of times equating it with religious aspects as well, like karma, you know, like I had the opportunity, like this God-given opportunity to be able to help out somebody and bring light into their families and so on and so forth. So very philosophical in a lot of ways. And I was just mind blown by the fact that, yeah, these are women who've barely had any education a lot of times, some of them quite well educated too, but could actually think and, yeah, think so deep and yeah, actually process so much of their emotions as well. So, yeah, very fascinating.
That's such an interesting story and such an interesting research topic, Lopa. I love it. I think that's actually all the time we have today. So thank you for coming and chatting. Sorry that Siobhan couldn't be here. She is sick and carrying her little baby in her belly. So we're letting her rest. But Lopa, where can we find you if we ever want to find out more about gestational surrogacy in India and around the world?
I'm going to take your advice and start my own social media accounts on this. But until then, I think I'm on LinkedIn. I'm also on ResearchGate. And yeah, just search with my name, and I think I'm the only one there. So yeah, you should be able to find me. But yeah, if anything changes until soon,
I'll let you guys know as soon as my bad influence of making scientists head on to social media, I'll let you know where Lopa is at. Thank you so much for chatting today, Lopa.
Thank you so much, Kristen. Thank you.
Bye. Welcome back to the episode. I mean, are we really welcoming you back? You've been here the whole time. Welcoming me back, although I was also still here. I don't know. I'm a little bit lost without Siobhan, if we haven't noticed. But I hope you really enjoyed my chat with Lopa all about gestational surrogacy in India. I really love the chat. I really hope that we can bring more surrogacy chat on here. What I'd really love to do is interview an intended parent and surrogate parent pair. I think that would be a really interesting conversation. So if you know one, or if you are one and you would love to come on the podcast, please let us know, because we would love to talk to you and find out what the experience was like in your country, in your circumstances, because I think that there isn't enough conversation about surrogacy had. It is becoming more prevalent or more publicized, so I'd love to hear from you so that other people can understand what the experience is like, and maybe we'll get some more scientists who understand the mental health and the attachment and everything around surrogacy a bit more on here later too. But for now, it was a really interesting conversation with Lopa. What else do I have for you? We usually have a Fun Fact Friday. My Fun Fact Friday brain is fried because my daughter, I think she's sick, but I don't really know, because she doesn't seem sick except for the fact that she wakes up in the middle of the night for a very long time and doesn't let me go back to sleep in my own bed. So she ends up kicking me all night. So at the moment, I'm very tired. I think it's just a software update. But anyways, I don't have any fun facts for this Tuesday/Friday. What I do have is fun news, I guess. This is Kristen, by the way, am launching my enamel pin. So if you haven't been following along on my Instagram, you wouldn't know this. It's a bit random, but I decided that I wanted to use enamel pins to talk about the things that I like and dislike, kind of get the things that I wear to tell people how I feel, with the intention of one day designing pins that say I'm autistic, not rude, or, you know, no hugs, which is what my clothing says at the moment. But that kind of takes some time and effort and a lot of money to start. So to begin with, I am selling some neurodiversity affirming, mental health affirming pins to see if you guys love them. So by the time you hear this, Summer Diversity should have gone live. That will be my shop. I will leave a link to it in the show notes so that you guys can head on over and have a look and see if there is something in there that helps you communicate your boundaries, your passions, and everything else in between. But yeah, I hope you love it. I hope you enjoy listening to this episode. I hope that you love yourself and your brain for every beautiful, unique part that it has, even the executive dysfunction, which we know isn't great, but like there are ways we can hack it to make it more functional than dysfunctional. I don't know. We'll see. I'm still trying to figure it out too. So we can all do it together as a family. A great big Parenting Unpacked family. Without Siobhan to rein me in, I'm going to get real weird. So I'm going to say goodbye now, friends. And we can all hope and pray that Siobhan will be back here next week on Parenting Unpacked as we interview yet another guest, because we have actually been very organized for once, which means that we've had to do even less work for ourselves. And we've organized guests so that we don't have to prepare content, you know, work smarter, not harder. I don't know if I was supposed to tell you that and let you in on that little secret. But anyways, I hope you enjoyed and I will see you next week. Bye.